Bene, buongiorno, grazie di essere qui. L'occasione speciale di ascoltare una lezione di Evgeny Morozov. Lui è un amico della Biennale, è stato qui anche nelle scorse edizioni, e questo dimostra qualcosa sia di Evgeny sia della Biennale. Evgeny è il rappresentante di una visione critica nei confronti dell'entusiasmo ingenuo e un po' ideologico nei confronti della tecnologia. Biennale Tecnologia è basata sull'idea che tecnologia è umanità, e quindi è complesso, non è fatta di semplici linee che tracciano il percorso che porta al futuro, chiamandolo progresso. Nel tempo in cui Evgeny Morozov ha cominciato a pubblicare le sue ricerche, forse alcuni di voi non ricordano nemmeno che era così, l'idea della tecnologia era coincidente con l'idea di progresso. L'idea base era che la nuova versione di una tecnologia è sempre migliore della precedente. Mentre noi siamo umani, abbiamo una complessità di dinamiche molto grande. La nuova tecnologia è sempre migliore della precedente, metteva in grado gli umani di pensare che il progresso fosse semplicemente lasciar fare alla tecnologia, perché basta che arrivi la prossima tecnologia e il mondo migliorerà. E c'era un entusiasmo intorno a questa cosa perché risolveva molti problemi. Diceva: ok, lasciamo che la tecnologia segua il suo corso e il mondo migliorerà. Evgeny guardava questa storia e diceva: non mi convince. Studiava criticamente questa dinamica e la raccontava da un punto di vista molto minoritario, molto diverso, nel quale si trovavano le contraddizioni e le negatività del progresso, cosiddetto progresso tecnologico, e le connetteva pian piano alla logica sottostante, che era fondamentalmente legata all'idea di neoliberismo. Ora, non la faccio troppo lunga perché io per primo non vedo l'ora di ascoltare il discorso di Evgeny e di quest'anno. Però vorrei, come dire, tracciare questo rapporto tra lo sviluppo di una tecnologia che va avanti da sola, perché la versione nuova è sempre migliore della precedente, in quella narrativa, la connessione di quella narrativa con la narrativa sottostante molto più grande, articolata, complessa del neoliberismo. Il neoliberismo, essendo un pensiero dell'economia che si fonda sull'idea che le imprese, le aziende abbiano un unico scopo, quello di fare profitti per gli azionisti. Lo ha detto Milton Friedman del 62, è diventato un mantra sempre più diffuso. Nel 79-80 Thatcher e Reagan vincono le loro elezioni in America e in Inghilterra, cominciano 40 anni, 30 anni di un pensiero unico nel quale tutto ciò che conta è che le imprese facciano profitto, lasciarle fare liberamente la loro azione, perché l'idea era che se si lascia fare al mercato si avrà la migliore allocazione possibile delle risorse, ci sarà la migliore condizione possibile, perché il mercato è una forma di gestione dell'informazione che massimizza la razionalità dell'uso delle risorse. Questa idea non era un'analisi, era un'ideologia. Oggi ce ne rendiamo conto anche di questo, stiamo imparando che questa ideologia era una scelta narrativa che consentiva a un potere economico molto grande di crescere nella libertà dalle costrizioni di politiche orientate a una redistribuzione, a una maggiore giustizia sociale, e ha contribuito a costruire una società molto polarizzata, molto nella quale l'elite e la parte ricca della popolazione, la parte meno abbiente della popolazione si allontanano sempre di più, diminuendo lo spazio del ceto medio. Questo ormai è nei dati, nella consapevolezza degli economisti, compresa l'OCSE, che è la grande centro di ricerca economica di Parigi. Quindi tutto quello che è successo è totalmente criticabile. Evgeny Morozov lo ha fatto, lo ha connesso alla storia della tecnologia, ha visto in anticipo rispetto a tutti noi il dipanarsi di questa ideologia che diventava potere, e ci ha aiutato a leggerla criticamente. E come sapete, ogni innovazione culturale ha bisogno prima di tutto di critica. Adesso che tutti sono consapevoli del lato critico della tecnologia, e non la sto a fare lunga, ma guardate il dibattito sulla tecnologia e vedrete quanto è articolato e critico oggi, adesso che molti sono andati in quella direzione, Evgeny sta cominciando a costruire, e oggi avremo una finestra sul pensiero di Evgeny Morozov, che dalla critica comincia a suggerire delle strade che ci possano incoraggiare a costruire una società più consapevole, ma anche migliore. Evgeny Morozov.
Buongiorno, devo avvisarvi che il mio discorso è in inglese perché l'ho scritto troppo tardi per tradurlo bene, quindi scusate. So, for those of you who follow me in English, let me just say that it's a pleasure to be back in Turin at this wonderful festival. I've spoken several times, and it's always a pleasure to see that there is a discussion about technology that's a little bit deeper, still happening somewhere, than what we normally get in the press and at tech conferences. So I applaud the organizers for consistently organizing such a great event with discussions that are intellectual and historical and cultural in nature, and not just focused on business and entrepreneurial sides. So I've written my speech, even though normally I just speak without any written materials, partly to help with the translation, so I apologize if it's going to sound a little bit algorithmic. That was not the intent. So let me begin. Let's be honest. Who today has the luxury to worry about big tech and things like the misuses of artificial intelligence or its concentration in the hands of just a few key players? The list of more pressing concerns is already embarrassingly long. The highly destructive war in Europe, the devastating energy crisis, the skyrocketing inflation, the lack of meaningful action on climate change, which is something that we saw discussed yesterday in a very provocative manner, these are just some of the few recent horrors that make worrying about big tech the luxurious preserve of the uninformed. Remember the good old times when our main concerns had to do with fake news, content farms in Macedonia, and the dark machinations of Cambridge Analytica. Measured against the more recent calamities I've just mentioned, a future dominated by Alphabet or Amazon may not even look that bleak. As public enemies go, the proverbial tech bros are certainly as obnoxious as they are badly dressed. And that's certainly one reason to dislike them, certainly in Italy. But they're almost certainly not the worst of the bunch of all the villains out there. Okay, perhaps except for Elon Musk, a man whose ego is larger even than his fortune, as well as his former PayPal buddy Peter Thiel, the guy who spends his own fortune funding efforts to extend longevity through blood transfusions from the young. However, apart from these two, today's big tech looks much weaker and humbler than it once did. Now that Facebook, or Meta, as its parent company is known, announced the massive layoffs that include 11,000 staff members, it's obvious that the metaverse is a project that doesn't have legs. Apologies for the pun, for those of you who get it. The crypto universe, in turn, also seems to have imploded on itself, as recently as this week, by the way. In the middle of all of this, the tech clash, a funky neologism meant to capture the growing public backlash against the big tech, died a quiet death. Just a few years ago, respectable publications like The Economist or The Financial Times had an infinite supply of editorials on the subject of the tech clash. It seemed that everyone was angry about fake news, tech billionaires, and the pilfering of our personal data. Today, this tech clash is a shadow of its former self, but not because the war on big tech has been won. Rather, I would argue, it's because almost everyone had accepted that there is no real alternative to these platforms. In a sense, the deflation of the moral panic around big tech is something of a second coming of the end of history. Just like with capitalism at the end of the Cold War, we seem to have tacitly accepted that the ways of living and being designed and operated by the big tech are here to stay. Just like with the long COVID, all we could hope for is to find ways of coexisting with the enemy. This might sound dystopian to some of you, and it certainly is. But this dystopia comes with the promise of a powerful, if misguided, utopia of its own. Thus, whatever the problems associated with our growing reliance on private digital infrastructures, the true ideologists of the digital assure us that ultimately all of these problems are resolvable. If only we stopped criticizing and got our hands dirty and started building, quote unquote, or at least regulating. So while today's things may be bad, making them better is possible and doable. We just need to be pragmatic. Whatever the excesses of a world dominated by Jeff Bezos of Mark Zuckerberg, they can be mitigated, or so we're told. Conversely, whoever is not already on board with this fixable techno-utopia train is almost automatically deemed a technophobe. And I heard that accusation launched at me more than once. But what is the exact content of this pragmatic techno-utopia, the yang to the ink of the techno-dystopia operated by the big tech? Having looked at it closely for many years, I can discern at least three distinct dimensions to it. It's grounded, first, in our excessive faith in the ability to regulate these commercial entities. Second, in our belief that having these firms compete with each other is the way to maximize innovation. And third, and finally, in our unreasonable expectation that technology platforms are the ideal vehicles for the perverse form of business-friendly humanitarianism that in my earlier work I dubbed solutionism. In short, this pragmatic techno-utopia that Silicon Valley itself peddles rests on our faith in the magic powers of regulation, competition, and solutionism. So let me foreshadow my conclusion. I do think that this is a false utopia and that a better one could and should be found. But before we think about alternatives, let me briefly address each of these three dimensions. So the first pillar of our false techno-utopian consensus rests on the widespread conviction that the power of big tech could be curtailed through new rules and regulations. For example, like the right to be forgotten or the rule for data mandates that would force tech giants to share the data that have been hoarding with other companies and the general public. As a result, the Wild West of the early digital culture would finally be brought under the wise tutelage of the state. The rules of the game, as the saying goes, could finally be laid down, extra profits could be taxed, new labor regulations for the gig economy could be established. Call me a skeptic, but it does take a lot of naivete not to see that it has been precisely the regulatory state itself that has preached the liberalization of labor regulations, the dismantling of antitrust and anti-monopoly regulations, the lowering of taxes, and so on, all the measures that make today's big tech possible. So while regulation can fix many of the issues that are correctly identified as problematic, the political subject to push for the right regulations seems to be a miss. Public opposition to big tech won't magically bring it into existence without some prior opposition to neoliberalism itself. But this won't happen as long as the main attacks on big tech come from the World Economic Forum in Davos or from the editorials that you see in the Financial Times. The second pillar of this new techno-utopian consensus rests on the assumption that the sheer creative, disruptive, and competitive spirit of capitalism could eventually erode the monolithic power of these firms. We just need to find a way to unleash it. And not only that, if only we manage to make the digital economy more competitive, plenty of beneficial consequences would follow. Perhaps data portability, perhaps compensation for user data, perhaps new services that the lazy digital monopolies of today do not want to launch. Thus, the expectation is that whatever the size and the might of the lobbying operations in Washington or Brussels, technology giants too can be disrupted, and by something more democratic or at least populist, more decentralized and lean. This, of course, is the promise of the crypto world and of Web3, which gives us the dramatic story of the old disruptors getting disrupted by the newer ones. But it's also the promise that some venture capitalist savior, the Neusoft Bank with its massive vision fund, for example, would come out of the woods and profoundly reshape the tech landscape of today. Wouldn't it be nice, after all, for them to fund some revolutionary technologies that would loosen the grip of Google and Facebook and Amazon on the digital economy of today? It's worth pointing out that perhaps if we need to be saved by venture capitalists to begin with, perhaps we should reconsider the benefits of perishing. This phase in competition rests on quite a bit of wishful thinking. The main players of the so-called big tech have so much free cash in their coffers that they can actually afford, as they frequently do, to simply buy up all of the existing competitors, along perhaps with the venture capitalists that fund them. Think once again about the metaverse and its missing legs. Another quick digression. Perhaps we ought to reflect on whether competition is really as great as everyone says. Do we really want to have 10 of the world's largest AI and cloud computing firms each dump $10 billion a year on research and development to develop what are essentially identical capabilities for the recognition of objects, images, texts, and voice? Isn't it one area where a centralized approach, treating some of these capabilities as public goods, would deliver shared benefits to many more players and at a fraction of the cost? There is no high rationality emerging from capitalist competition. Often it's quite irrational in its outcomes, even if the individual capitalists are doing what's rational for them. This, at any rate, is something that both Marx and Weber, in different ways, taught us a long time ago. There is no reason to forget that. So regulation and competition are two of the three components of the tech utopia that Silicon Valley paddles that I've been describing so far. The third component, solutionism, rests on the perverse hope that big tech itself, with enough moral persuasion, could be turned into a positive force in the world. With all the artificial intelligence and other data-related reaches under the tight control, the technology platforms could at least be asked to use their immense might for good. Can they assist in finding the cure for cancer, or eradicating disease, or solving the world hunger, and solving many other problems? Perhaps one day, even the bloodthirsty Peter Thiel can be domesticated and introduced to the charms of a tofu-based diet, after all. We are allowed to dream, right? I first wrote about it a decade ago, but this solutionist stuff is still very much with us. If back then, when I first wrote it, it was primarily manifested in an infinite string of humanitarian hackathons, often held under the lofty auspices of the United Nations, today it is to be seen in the world of so-called DAOs, This logic has spread far beyond the world of technology. Now even asset managers like BlackRock want to save the world by giving us an opportunity to invest into some ethically and morally sound stock index. It's truly an effortless and frictionless utopia. In the best of cases, we can go about our peaceful bourgeois existence, punctuated as it is by homemade kombucha, yoga, and occasional trips to some exotic faraway lands, all while contributing something to the positive social change, often without even noticing it. If two or three decades ago it was only consumption that was ethical, today no activity can afford not to be. Investing, communicating, perhaps even sleeping, there is always a more ethical option available via some slick digital app. Regulate, innovate, solve problems. This is our own mini-tech utopia of today. Has achieved a nearly hegemonic status. It's definitely not the wild cyber utopias of the early 1990s, of course, with their promise of world peace by means of virtual reality. No one talks about virtual sex anymore, an interesting indication of just how much our initial ambitions have shrunk. However, today's techno-utopia is far more pragmatic and not only grounded in actual, not virtual reality, but proud of it, hoping to design some algorithmic protocol that would cleverly allow to offset carbon emissions by means of the blockchain or something similar. This hegemonic aspect of the pragmatic techno-utopia that I've been outlining is important because it unites the old big tech of Facebook and Amazon and Google with the Web3 crypto universe of new and smaller startups. With the exception of a few libertarians, all of them buy into the same package of regulation, competition, solutionism. Remember how, at the height of the tech clash just a few years ago, even Mark Zuckerberg complained that Facebook wasn't regulated enough, begging Congress for new rules and actions. This, to me, is the reflection of this hegemonic acceptance that ultimately regulation will do good to the digital economy. So what is not to like about this utopian future? Of course, one can criticize such pragmatic utopias on many grounds, not least for the lack of efficacy, the tendency to overpromise and underdeliver, the excessive reliance on financial mechanisms and incentives to accomplish social objectives. These are not the kind of critiques or criticisms that I'd like to advance today, even though they are, of course, important and must continue to be made. No, my main beef with these techno-utopias is that they are extremely boring, unimaginative, and at the end of the day, deeply conservative in their political outlook. Given my past critiques of cyber-utopianism, I thought I'd never be saying something like this, but I do prefer my techno-utopias wild and radical. And today's are not. So what we have in front of us today is rather meek and pathetic. Wild and radical, it definitely isn't. So let me backtrack a little bit. For a long time, which is almost 15 years now, ever since I started writing about the tech industry, I thought that the main problem with Silicon Valley and the cheerleaders in the rest of the world was their excessive utopianism. Today, I'm not so sure. I think that the main problem is that our own techno-utopianism of today is shallow, thin, and cannibalistic on the market utopias that ultimately undergird neoliberal ideology, which is the truly hegemonic ideology of today. Even to call it utopianism is a bit of a stretch. Mostly it's just a way to package the basic tenets of neoliberal thought into the supposedly neutral language of innovation, disruption, and governance. This stuff passes for utopia only because it involves latest technology and is extremely naive about how the real world, you know, the stuff of multi-billion asset managers, the CIA, and sovereign wealth funds, actually works. Here, then, is one of the main ideas I'd like you to take away from this talk. Today's scaled-down and pragmatic techno-utopianism is really yesterday's neoliberalism by other means. And neoliberalism, despite what it preaches about disruption, is actually an extremely conservative ideology, as I have already indicated. For all its embrace of creative disruption, it is disruption and destruction, it is actually firmly opposed to any organized effort to stimulate and produce innovation that does not come from market mechanisms. So here comes another soundbite. The pragmatic utopia preached by big tech and Web3 alike is not at all different from what some of you know as neoliberal dystopia. These are just two sides of the same coin, pun intended. Of course, much here depends on how one defines neoliberalism. And I work with a very peculiar definition, which, as they say, needs to be unpacked. So I see it primarily as an effort to reshape how innovation happens in society by shifting all of it onto the market sphere and blocking or neglecting its production in the non-market spheres, not least because they are considered remnants of the past and the bastions of reaction. Thus, I see neoliberalism as an ideology that revolves around one broader point, namely that the institutions of the market offer us the only possible means of achieving large-scale social coordination that allows for progress and human development. On this view, the market offers us the only workable path to problem solving, to generating large-scale progressive social change, and particularly important in the last few decades, to innovation. Neoliberalism, in other words, is how society comes to systematically produce novelty at scale by relying on the market as the only logic of social organization. Thus, when the most innovative and consistent defenders of neoliberalism insist that there is no alternative, they don't really mean to imply that there are no alternative ways of distributing essential goods or satisfying your hunger. They are no longer arguing that markets are always better than governments at resource allocation, for example. Some of them would even tacitly acknowledge that with big data and artificial intelligence and quantum computing, governments may be able to distribute resources as efficiently as Amazon does, for example. So people preaching the virtues of fully automated luxury communism, for example, and related digital socialist utopias, where Walmart and Amazon offer us a template for the new planned economy of some kind, are fighting mostly futile rhetorical battles. I'm convinced that the most progressive, so to say, strands of the neoliberal thought would happily concede and acknowledge that. But markets, at least for the sophisticated neoliberals I've just been describing, do something else that government planning, regardless of how much artificial intelligence you put into it, would never allow. They allow the civilization to move forward, to express its creativity, to develop new practices and techniques and institutions. Essentially, they are the means of bringing a novelty into the world and doing so at scale and consistently. And who amongst us is against novelty? Who amongst us has a better institutional program for doing it outside of the market? It's in this sense that the slogan "there is no alternative" uttered by the most sophisticated neoliberals makes sense. And bear with me through this somewhat theoretical digression. My favorite example here is someone like James Buchanan, who of course won a Nobel Prize, who is one of the most controversial neoliberal thinkers out there, who even lauded markets as infrastructures of becoming. And that's the exact word that he used. For those of you familiar with theoretical literature, this of course is much closer to Deleuze than it is to neoclassical economics. In fact, even Buchanan himself was surprised to discover how much his own thought on this had in common with Whitehead, who of course was a reference point for Deleuze himself. Buchanan is very interesting here because, writing in the early 1990s, he easily concedes that computers, and today it would be things like big data or artificial intelligence, might actually help socialism and central planning resolve all of the allocative challenges of feeding people and satisfying their basic needs, like providing them with food or a roof to sleep under. But even if this happened, technology still wouldn't help central planners to do anything about this creative problem solving, new forms of collective and social learning, and of course of the very becoming that I've just been describing to you. That in essence is his argument. The only vehicle for progressivism, defined at least as the reliance on science and technology to move society forward and institutionalize the new, is market-based neoliberalism. Everything else is the mere shuffling of chairs on the Titanic, so to say. Thus, big data and AI can be of great help in the socialist mission of this chair reshuffling. Perhaps we can do that in a more egalitarian manner, but that's all that these tools can accomplish, at least in this more sophisticated neoliberal paradigm. Now, let me move to the more concrete and hopeful parts of my talk, where I'd like to flag some of the ways to break the status quo. Thinking about alternatives to the current regime and its utopian rhetoric is extremely hard, as many of you surely know from your own experience. Often this is because the search starts from the wrong premises. Like good hackers, we look at existing technologies, search, social networking, the blockchain, and we try to imagine how these technologies can be repurposed to serve some alternative political project. In reality, though, the institutional and ideological contours of this alternative project remain extremely blurry, even if we do find new uses for the technologies at hand. Thus, at our most radical best, we are likely to invoke the word socialism, quote unquote, juxtaposing the democratic government to the mostly undemocratic market. But the moment we make this move, the neoliberal chimera returns, unleashing its unusual set of arguments about how governments and central planners will never be able to supply us with all the institutional infrastructures that enable progress, learning, becoming, innovation, and whatnot. The subsequent moves for those of us on the left are not many. Perhaps we can find some middle ground under nebulous concepts like the entrepreneurial state, meekly pointing out that the war in Vietnam had a silver lining and it eventually gave us the iPhone. Or we can simply amp up the glamour part of it all, promising that once Amazon-like algorithms take care of satisfying our basic needs, we would have all the free time in the world to enjoy the fruits of the fully automated luxury communism I've just mentioned. Having thought about this for years now, I've come to believe that this repertoire of responses to the neoliberal challenge is way too limited. The entire neoliberal project, as it emerged during the Cold War, has left a legacy that has greatly affected not only the ideological and political outlook of its proponents, but also that of its opponents. At the heart of neoliberal ideology lies a dichotomy between the market and the state, with its insistence that our only choice in managing complexity, in allocating goods, and in producing novelty is between entrusting them to free, willing, and creative entrepreneurs or robot-like soulless technocrats. That's the dichotomy that we're still working with if you are attuned to the public debate in the media and elsewhere. This choice between the creative entrepreneur and the robotic bureaucrat is quite ubiquitous and omnipresent. But all the other social units that are sandwiched between the market and the state are deemed to be either ineffective because too small or archaic because they're seen as a remnants of the pre-industrial civilization. So everything that made life beyond the factory, the supermarket, and the office bearable and exciting, you know, the stuff of neighborhoods, squares, libraries, bookshops, citizen associations, evening schools, and whatnot, all of this is deemed either irrelevant, ineffective, archaic, or outright harmful. Or at least it doesn't have any space in this theoretical framework in which both of us on the left and on the right are operating. Innovation, thus, is deemed to be the product and the consequence of the magic workings of the market system, with its ability to work off information that was widely distributed before in individual heads and was now suddenly brought together under the auspices of the market. It was the proverbial entrepreneur who, by finding new and better ways of producing, brought society forward. It was through such entrepreneurial activity that novelty was discovered, institutionalized, and distributed through society. It's not by accident, of course, that Hayek titled one of his most famous essays, "Competition as a Discovery Procedure." This element of discovery is extremely important in the neoliberal imaginary. In this imaginary, the entrepreneur became akin to the avant-garde artist who was always experimenting and enacting new and radical forms of the future. But this future was not expressed through the bold artistic ventures one associates with the avant-garde. Rather, it took the form of gadgets, widgets, and consumer products of various kinds, the stuff that you buy in IKEA rather than see in an art gallery. It's not surprising that this entrepreneurial paradigm then spread out to other domains of social life. As a result, today we also speak about idea entrepreneurs, political entrepreneurs, moral entrepreneurs, and of course, social entrepreneurs. The fact that such entrepreneurization of the social has remained uncontested, acquiring a nearly hegemonic status, is partly the consequence of the left's inability to offer a workable alternative a workable alternative non-market vision and a model for how novelty could be tamed and institutionalized through other identities that are not those of the entrepreneur. This alternative wasn't offered in part because many thinkers on the left found these processes already at work in what they call culture. And here I don't mean the elite culture of art galleries or biennales like this one, but the kind of expansive everyday culture that through the work of people like Raymond Williams or Stuart Hall formed the bedrock of cultural studies. And we saw, as with so much in academia, this discovery of culture by the academic complex ended up moving the strand of thought in a rather arcane direction, where the goal became showing how the oppressed, be they the workers or sexual or radical minorities and the subaltern, managed to heroically resist the cultural greed of their oppressors. So it all became about the glorification of their resistance, even if the early work of people like Raymond Williams still tried to make sense of how various institutions of the welfare state, like the BBC or the Open University or even the NHS in Britain, contributed to that cultural resistance. The institutional landscape that made such acts of resistance potent was not of much interest to the academics and theorists that followed. Rather, they looked to language, not institutions, for analytical insights. By and large, theirs became a story of us living in the best of all possible worlds already, at least if only we practiced enough psychogeography and derif in the hopes of turning our everyday life into a battlefield against oppression. This is where the pragmatism of neoliberal thinkers proved far more superior. They left it to the likes of Ayn Rand, celebrated, of course, by Peter Thiel, to celebrate the heroic acts of resistance of individual entrepreneurs against the stale mass civilization of bureaucracy and government. Instead, these neoliberal thinkers employed their imagination and political clout to enact the sort of institutional environment, think of the World Trade Organization or even parts of the European Commission, at least the pro-competition rules that it emits, that would help in the flourishing of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial mentality. The systematic production of entrepreneurial subjects was anything but laissez-faire. It was a well-organized and well-funded effort. The neoliberals were thinking not just institutionally, but also infrastructurally. In a world dominated by Google and Amazon, not to mention Instagram and TikTok, and potentially even their crypto adversaries, what other choice do we have but to turn ourselves into entrepreneurs of some kind? So here's a hint for what one of the first building blocks of our wild leftist techno-utopia might look like. We need more structures of support, and here I mean structures that are technological, political, and economic, for the production of actors and practices that are pro-innovation, but not necessarily pro-entrepreneurship. In other words, we need to de-entrepreneurize the social, cleansing it of the idea that entrepreneurship and associated practices are the best conceptual container for social institutional innovation. This would almost certainly entail the rediscovery of the idea that there is far more novelty and innovation in culture, conceived once again in the expansive sense that someone like Raymond Williams gave to it, than in the so-called economy, which has always been the favorite domain of neoliberalism. Here's the second point I'd like you to take home today. The major goal of a post-capitalist or non-capitalist project should not be to beat neoliberals at the economy, as the previous projects, for example, in the Soviet Union or China, tried to do. Rather, it should be to show that as far as the Hayekian discovery procedures go, the learning and innovation pipeline offered to us by capitalist competition is relatively weak, costly, and actually often infertile. The reason why neoliberals managed to convince everyone that competition and hence markets are the only game in town is because they have always juxtaposed them to bureaucracy and government planning, as I have already mentioned. But the real opposite pole to competition and economy is not government and bureaucracy, it's society and culture. How does it all relate to technology, you might be wondering? Well, our task should be to figure out how to build institutions and infrastructures that would allow to turn the creative spirit at the heart of our culture, in this non-elitist and expansive definition I've given you, into a new source of value and social reproduction. To some extent, that's what the cultural studies missed back in the 1970s. Our everyday life is pregnant not only with opportunities for resistance, but also with opportunities for innovation and social reproduction that are not inferior and often actually superior to those that one finds in the so-called economy. What follows from this rather abstract framing is that today's neoliberal techno-capitalism doesn't offer us the only framework for systematically producing innovation. It might seem a banal and trivial point to make, but I would argue it isn't. There hardly passes a day when we, the ordinary citizens, don't discover a better or clever way of doing things that society takes for granted. Cooking a dish, cleaning up our apartments, learning a foreign language, fixing a broken chair. By nature, we're active beings who thrive on encountering and creatively circumventing unforeseen challenges. In the process of solving these micro problems, we experience a sense of triumph and mastery. If we are lucky, we might even stumble upon an ingenious way to improve some basic, seemingly internal process that, in retrospect, does appear to take far too much energy and time. But what happens afterwards? Under current conditions, most likely, we merely keep using that method that we've discovered to improve our own lives, creating little private utopias for ourselves. This is in most cases where the social innovation process ends. It ends in our heads and hands. The potentially socially beneficial methods and techniques that we do discover, often without trying, don't get shared widely, not even with our neighbors or even family members. There's not been a greater waste of intelligence that we have observed in recent history. We can do so much, but we're actually doing so little. Most of this intelligence actually dies instead of becoming part of techniques that the rest of society could benefit from. No amount of artificial intelligence or cloud computing could compensate for that. Our entire political economic system is structurally biased against such elicitations of intelligence, unless, of course, it's done via the mechanism of the market. Thus, most of the small discoveries that we do make on a daily basis simply die a quiet death. Why so? Well, the barriers to the effective communication and social institutionalization of such discoveries on a global scale are simply too high. That's why most of us don't even bother sharing these discoveries with others. We might write a tweet or post a photo, but that's where such communication usually ends. And this is so for a reason. As I've already said, our social systems are simply not configured to maximize social innovations that are produced, or in many cases merely unearthed by its members. As a result, the only available path for scaling up and universalizing such discoveries is to commercialize them via the market. This can undoubtedly produce some of the desired outcomes, leveraging the capitalist quest for profitability in order to make the most obscure and unthinkable products widely accessible in the most remote areas of the globe. Such a commercialization, however, also imposes a certain institutional straitjacket on the innovators. And here I'm talking about most young people who discover something new and interesting, having no other choice but to form a startup and seek venture capital funding to actually realize the idea, so to bring it to a level that's far less abstract that I've described in my written document. As a result, this push to commercialize via the market and by forming startups and seeking venture capital funding forces these innovators to become mere startups that are working off a business model. No matter how unsustainable, disruptive, and inappropriate this business model might be for the task at hand. So this is the trade-off. What, at least under the current system, what one gains in reach and universality, one is likely to lose in terms of one's flexibility when it comes to alternative forms of social organization. So it's not by accident that a lot of the startups have no choice but to start monetizing user data and engage in all sorts of dubious practices, because it's what they need in order to make their payroll and to pay their bills, right? This is the system that essentially they enter. So how does this dynamic work in practice? Suppose that in your everyday life, you have found some clever way of studying and memorizing words in a foreign language, to give you a very practical example. If you think that your solution is truly revolutionary, and it will be embraced by thousands or even millions of people, Of course, you are unlikely to keep it to yourself, using it merely to study all the languages in the world yourself. No, it's far more likely that you will indeed try to scale it up, and there is only a path to doing it in today's world. You're most likely to do it by commercializing your invention and by raising capital, that I've already described to you. You will less spend time and effort trying to convince others to invest into a new venture, so that the initial innovation could go from being a mere prototype to becoming an missable mass product, and a usable mass product as well. Of course, it's possible that the stars do align in your favor, and a successful product would in fact be launched as a result of your discoveries. You will, however, probably have to repay the initial funds that you raised. This would impose a certain business model, as I already mentioned, which will most likely be built around subscriptions or some combination of data extraction from your users or the subsequent generation of advertising revenue based on that data. This will turn this new and revolutionary technique for studying languages that you've developed into a mere commodity while also turning you into a corporation. There is nothing new under the sun here, of course. This is how such commercialization of invention has always worked under capitalism. This is also why the well-known defenders of capitalism, like Friedrich Hayek, that I already mentioned, identified the so-called cash nexus as a vehicle of progress for humanity as a whole. Whatever the local costs for some, be it inequality or unfairness of some outcomes, the total benefits of imposing economic relations on what were previously non-commercial contexts and processes are always greater, or so at least Hayek tries to convince us. And they are greater not only in terms of lowering the cost of production while equipping humanity with new knowledge and capabilities for action, but also on many other fronts. So I'll be wrapping up soon, so I'll have to cut a few paragraphs, so bear with me. So what does digitization change in this regard? I'd argue quite a few things. First of all, so many of our actions have suddenly become observable, thanks to sensors and other types of smart systems that are now ubiquitous in so many spaces around us, most of what we do is recorded. As a result, more of our everyday life could become subject for reflection and empirically validated analysis. This is not necessarily something to worry about. This is something to worry about under the current system. Thus, even in our smart homes, we are constantly invited upon to reflect on trends, patterns, and statistics. Again, not necessarily a bad thing. Second, today even a trivial amount of technological knowledge and skill gets one much further than it did 10 or 5 years ago. Even without learning how to code, we can truly do more with less. On this, the techno-utopians of the 1990s were absolutely correct. Such augmented resourcefulness, however, is likely to remain a permanent feature of the digital environment, but in a very curtailed manner, providing ordinary users with the unprecedented, if not fully realized, powers to act. And it's precisely about the necessity to build institutions and structures that would allow us to realize those powers that I think our own debate should be. So that was partly the good news. The not so good news is that there are also great limits that today's digital economy imposes on humanity's newly found capacities for reflexivity and transformative action. The greatest of them is that such capacities are tightly circumscribed within the logic of the digital platforms and the apps that populate them. Whatever social discoveries are made by the newly empowered self-reflexive agents and groups that I've been describing must eventually fit into that logic, with the associated imperatives to monetize user data or charge subscriptions and share revenue with the platform itself. This market-based model could and does produce some benefits, and I don't want to deny that. But should it be the only template for organizing how digital society operates and institutionalizes social innovation? Should every person who, in learning languages digitally, for example, discovers an even cleverer way to do it, be forced to choose between doing nothing, as is mostly the case now, or becoming a startup entrepreneur? Doesn't this one-size-fits-all solution eventually come to restrain the institutional repertoires that are available for problem solving? And wouldn't a proper non-capitalist system seek to find ways to enrich our repertoires of action in society and culture, rather than in society and the market, and do so in a way that the new techniques and methods that we discover while acting actually shared as widely as possible? In conclusion, let me emphasize the key point that I would like you to take home today. We must choose our utopias carefully. Today's technologies are extremely powerful, and we need to make sure that we dream big. We can, of course, end up with something pragmatic and end up with a world where we do secure the current model that already exists, hoping that with regulation, competition, and a heavy dose of solutionism, we would be able to make big tech bearable. This, however, would be to betray the truly radical potential that many digital technologies do offer, without even trying to understand where early generations of utopians, some of them socialists and some of them not, made mistakes. A much better move would be to accuse capitalism of a terrible crime, that is, of systematically suppressing innovation. Living under capitalism, we are constantly punching below our weight as a species, and we cannot go on like this forever, because due to climate change, we would suffer dearly for it. To some extent, this charge of suppressing innovation was also the charge that Marx waged at the capitalist system. But if Marx, with his positivist or somewhat positivist outlook, still thought that the way forward was to centrally plan everything and act rationally, a less positivist socialism of today or tomorrow would probably want to simply create spaces, institutions, and infrastructures where novelty and innovation can flourish in the non-market conditions. This, to me, seems to be the content of a truly radical post- or non-capitalism. And in this utopia, digital technologies do have a big role to play. Thank you very much.
Grazie Evgeny. La ricerca che stai conducendo continua. Questo è lo spazio che abbiamo, circa 10-12 minuti per le domande. E mi sto chiedendo se voi volete segnalarmi la vostra intenzione di partecipare a questa parte dell'evento, del nostro incontro con Evgeny Morozov. Lo so che la prima domanda è sempre la più difficile, quindi vi consiglio di passare alla seconda, ed eccola qua, di Helga Novotny. Evgeny sa parlare italiano benissimo. Lui viene dalla Bielorussia, lavora in Italia da molto tempo, parla benissimo l'italiano, ma la sua precisione intellettuale lo conduce a pensare che forse è meglio che parli in inglese.
No, vabbè,
io lo lascerei parlare come vuole lui, ma in una conversazione forse in italiano viene più facile. Comunque la prima domanda sarà in inglese.
Thank you. I'm wondering whether you would agree that we need to speak much more about social innovation instead of only focusing on technological innovation. Because this is the dominant discourse when you speak about innovation. Whoever uses the word has in mind what you described, the commercialization, the kind of business models, etc. While we know how important social innovations are, in real life, if you have a technological innovation, let's say in a hospital, you have a new fantastic diagnostic technology. Unless you reorganize the day-to-day work in the hospital, including the hierarchy of knowledge and expertise, you will not get very far. And this is completely undervalued. It's taken for granted. So I think in order to support your project and the outline of this different kind of utopia, it would be important to make this much more, make people aware we are doing social innovations, and this would be one way of, you know, creating the kind of space that you advocate.
Sure. Well, thank you for this question. I can surely engage with that. So personally, I would not make the difference between technological and social innovation for the simple reason that I think it's a very contentious terrain to decide what is social and what is technological. The distinction I would make would be between market innovation and non-market innovation. if you want to call the non-market innovation social, that's fine by me, but it then presents market innovation as asocial, which I also can't accept because markets are embedded in society and rest on all sorts of contributions that are non-economic in nature. So for me, the right dichotomy in some sense would be market innovation versus non-market innovation. And from there you can then build all sorts of distinctions because ultimately a lot of market innovation is both social and technological in character, but so is a lot of non-market innovation. But clearly a hospital that is funded through tax money and public funds in a way it's four different objectives than a hospital that is focusing on the bottom line and profitability because it has to operate on the market. And the rhythm and the tempo in which this innovation happens, I think largely is determined by whether it's profit-oriented in outlook or not, right? And that I think is what determines the shape and the direction of, and the nature of innovation in question.
È molto rilevante questa egemonia del concetto di mercato che sembra essere l'unico spazio, l'unico contesto nel quale poter pensare l'innovazione, praticare l'innovazione, dice Evgeny, mentre non è così, probabilmente lo crediamo, ma non è necessariamente così. Si può pensare, invece che pensare economia, si può pensare dentro un contesto che è fatto, per esempio, di cultura, ha detto durante il suo discorso Evgeny Morozov. Se uno pensa dentro un contesto che è fatto di cultura, la logica non è quella del mercato, ma altre logiche che fanno sì che possiamo valutare il successo probabile di un'innovazione. Io sto parlando solo per darvi l'opportunità di alzare una mano e intervenire. Là in fondo, per piacere.
Thank you. I will actually ask the question in English if that's all right with you. So it's a bit complicated to actually express explicitly, but the thing that crosses my mind often when we discuss about this is the fact that we always think that there is the possibility, maybe this is an exaggeration, but that there is still the possibility that we can still do that. Because I don't think really that's the case. I mean, I can only speak about artificial intelligence, why is not about cultural sort of innovation. But in order to do something tremendous and something really, really big or really, really radical, you need to have some capabilities that your, I don't know, local family doesn't have, that will not have, that it is impossible to have. And you cannot, in a sense, I wouldn't want to use the word compete, but you cannot create some innovation that can profoundly change our life and so on and so forth, unfortunately, out of the scope of the people that hold all the data that they have collected in one way or another and all these capabilities. And the thing is that also one thing to bear in mind that while that is unfortunate, and I do not see how we can find another way around that, because you need that information, you need those capabilities to do something towards AI that is truly profound. It's impossible otherwise. Also, another thing to bear in mind is that while we're doing that, so let's say there is a bunch of people in that direction trying to find another way to do that without necessarily being the next Facebook or being the next, I don't know, whoever, we also have to think that there are also other countries in the world that are not interested at all in this question. And they will not stop just because all of a sudden, let's say, people in democratic countries, predominantly in the West, determine that, oh, wait, we don't like this, we want to do better. They will not stop. So there is a sense of competition there as well. I mean, there is a lot of pressure to be taken into account as to how things may unfold that, unfortunately, even if you would assume, or there would be some groups that would assume to make some other use or try to come up with some other use of artificial intelligence, there is a lot of pressure going around, unless it's global, which is difficult to imagine.
Thank you very much.
Well, it was a lot. I can give another talk for an hour.
Yeah.
No, there was a part about artificial intelligence that I had to skip due to time limits. I mean, look, much depends on how we want to define the very debate about artificial intelligence. We can, of course, narrow it to the definitions and frameworks that are supplied to us by institutions like Stanford or MIT, where the debate is extremely technical, and it's mostly about the right path to teach a machine to recognize objects in a photo. I think to reduce this debate to that dimension would be extremely politically, ideologically, and culturally limiting and damaging. You know, I'm reminded of a quote of something that Einstein said a while ago when he defined, he said that, you know, a true mark of intelligence is not knowledge but imagination, right? And I think if this is the mark of intelligence, then it should also be the mark of artificial intelligence in some sense, right? And that means, to me at least, that we have to be able to define the actor whose intelligence we want to replicate in some way as a socially situated being that's situated in a particular cultural, institutional, economic, and class milieu, right? And it means that, you know, intelligence is widely distributed in society. It's not concentrated in our heads. You know, the reason why I'm capable of thinking the thoughts I'm thinking is partly because I am surrounded by certain institutions. And the better those institutions are, and the more receptive they are to me, the more intelligently I would act, or so I hope, if we stick to basic conventions of rationality, which means that the way to improve artificial intelligence is also by focusing on institutions, and by making sure that our institutions are functional, that they actually provide for us, that they offer us healthcare and education under conditions that are not dependent on the market. And it's from there that truly intelligent society develops. It does not develop from putting more and more data into data farms and expecting that we will have capacities for recognizing objects. I mean, you can develop all of those capabilities, but if the humans outside of the farms are starving or homeless or sleeping on the streets as they are in parts of Palo Alto, who have lived for 2 years, that intelligence is not worth much, regardless of how much money you pour into it.
Just to have an idea of what could be innovation in a context that is not the market, can I ask you, I've been interviewing Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, because I was looking into the context of the idea of community. And I asked him, as Evgeny has said, we need to think big even without the market. I asked him if a community can scale, can become very big. And he said, no, communities don't scale because they are people knowing each other, sharing the same rules, having a traditional situation in which they trust each other. But what we can do is to create tools that enlarge, make big impact of what communities do. So in a way, Wikipedia is a sort of tool that creates a big impact of the activity of a community of encyclopedists that do something for the public good.
Well, I have a lot to say here. I do think Jimmy Wales is ultimately libertarian, and he's always been one, and he remains one. And there is a certain fetishism that he expresses for technology and community as a response to problems that could be solved differently. For me, the answer is not to scale up the community of Wikipedia, which exists on donations that Google and Firefox and others, Mozilla, throw at them. You know, Wikipedia, it's that. It's basically hustling us for money and hustling big tech for money. And the moment big tech disappears, somebody will have to pay their bills. For me, the answer clearly is a public service, public sector equivalent to the likes of Britannica or the encyclopedias that we had before that were in private hands, were extremely expensive, and were handled by the market. Like, the answer there, it's not to have a completely market and charity-supported version of Wikipedia. You know, this is the model that some right-wing philosophers obsessed with charity might design. No, like Sloterdijk, for example. No, I would like to have a system where, as long as we keep our taxation system in place, knowledge is funded publicly, there are people whose mission it is to curate and produce knowledge, and whose job it is and who are paid for it. And to me, this is a much better system. It doesn't mean that we should be ignoring contributions from the bottom up and all the things that I've mentioned, but I think we have to be able to distinguish between highly ambitious projects, of which knowledge creation should be one, which should be funded in a centralized manner, and kind of more decentralized, edgy projects that are about new emerging cultural practices, which you can fund in a decentralized manner. Because the last thing I want to do is to be funding space missions the way we are funding Wikipedia.
Yeah. Right. Well, se volete provare l'ebbrezza di sentire Eugenio in italiano, fategli una domanda in italiano, se no continuate come volete in inglese. Prego. C'è la, qui una domanda? Là. Cerchiamo di fare domande brevi, per favore, perché ormai stiamo uscendo dal tempo. Una, due e tre là in fondo. Le raccogliamo tutte insieme così? Ok.
Mi sentite? Sì. La mia domanda è brevissima. Non dovremmo, cioè, cosa significa innovazione? Non dovremmo partire dal ripensare il concetto di innovazione per poter poi disancorarlo al concetto di mercato?
Ok, grazie. Facciamo, raccogliamole tutte e tre così Evgeny risponde a tutte, perché poi dovremo lasciare la sala. Come sapete c'è un tema di sicurezza, la prossima comincia alle 11:30, ma dobbiamo prima uscire tutti e poi rientrare.
Ok, thank you for the talk. Yeah, my question is in regards to the cybersecurity. So to impulse the social innovation, using open source materials, databases, open tools, for example, there exists this cybersecurity constraint. So how can we reach the true artificial intelligence in a secure way using certified tools, for example?
Thank you for this conversation. Quick one. There's a rising wave, especially in the philanthropic and nonprofit world, of initiatives for secondary use of privately held data for the public interest. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? How that plugs into your vision?
Yes, okay. So, okay, I'll do the English just to save time. So on innovation, I do think that we have to rethink the current praxis of innovation, because it has been co-opted by the likes of World Bank and, you know, the IMF, and even the term social innovation has been co-opted by the European Commission and many other institutions. So I don't want us to stop thinking about it, but to me, innovation is ultimately the production of new and the refinement of techniques that were in place before and making them different, right? Of course, it's heavily culturally and politically dependent. That's something that's more efficient and faster for me is ultimately destructive to somebody else. And we've discovered that with the climate debate, that ultimately everything is relative and what seems efficient is highly inefficient. So I don't want to impose any criteria. And I think if there was a problem in the traditional Marxist project, it was the idea that you can think about forces of production objectively, social needs objectively, and I'm not so sure. So it has to be in some way made more flexible and open to competing interpretations. On the question of cybersecurity, I don't really have much to add other than, from what I understand, relying on open source and free software infrastructures in no way compromises your security, and perhaps it enhances it. So in as much as we can force our public institutions not just to be using these products, but to actually be funding their refinement, maintenance, and further generation, I'll be all for it. Right? And it's a kind of chicken and egg problem, where the reason why many of them seem unusable and insecure is because there is not enough money flowing into them, and the only actor that should be putting a lot of money into it should be the public sector, because that would be then the way to save on the tenders with Microsoft's and other companies of that kind. So on the question of public trusts and data, I mean, it fits. It fits in a sense that The last part of my talk where I was talking about the way in which sensors, to some extent also artificial intelligence, and even parts of the smart city render life more quantifiable, but also as an extension of that, more reflectable, if that's the right word in English, or at least easier to reflect upon, I find it as a good thing, right? The way in which this capacity to reflect upon social processes and use it almost for pedagogical way, the way in which it might compromise the privacy of individuals whose data allows for all of this reflection, of course, is a debate that needs to be held. I do think that the solution you outlined, and that I know a lot of people also here in Turin have been working on, I do think it's reasonable. Ultimately, I think the blockage to the greater uptake and the scaling up of such systems, it has to do with political institutions, and particularly institutions of the state and public institutions, realizing that the ability to reflect upon trends, whether these trends have to do with epidemics, transportation, education, and so forth, even the movements of financial markets and whether people are searching more for certain things as an indication on inflationary trends, all of that does not have to be the courtesy of Google, which is the one that amassed all this information, right? So the more we can decentralize the production, the gathering, and then the subsequent use of this information by smaller units, the more we will make it easier for the public sector and for ordinary citizens to grasp that perhaps even when it comes to building epidemiological models, we would be better off with a different way of gathering data, using it, acting upon it, and modeling. And I think that's one thing that's missing from the landscape as of now.
Bene, grazie Evgeny, grazie al pubblico per questo intervento e ci vediamo. Helga Novotny, che ha fatto la prima domanda, la ritroviamo proprio in questa sala domani alle 11:00.